taxation, also known as the Jewish CRA. This actually was a topic that I thought was going to be easy, in the sense that I've spoken on the topic before. I do lunch and learns sometimes at different accounting firms, and I did one at Schwartz, Levitsky, Feldman. If you remember the Panama Papers that came out a couple of years ago, in which it was discovered that high-ranking people from various countries were avoiding taxes via more than one firm in Panama. So at the time I gave a class, or actually two classes, on tax evasion and tax avoidance. And as part of that, I got into a discussion about what would Judaism consider to be an ethical system of taxing a population. And I came to certain conclusions in the course of that class, and I thought, okay, so now for this session, I can just revisit that and maybe tailor it a little bit, and it'll be good to go. But then I started looking at it and realized that since that time, I've changed my mind on most of the things that I said in that session. I had to start from scratch. At the time, I read three papers by a professor from the University of Arizona who dealt with Judaism and taxation, and I was really taken by what he had to say. But, you know, the word taken, it's like the Rona commercial on the radio, where you can say, well, I can't believe you did that, or I can't believe you did that. So it wasn't like, and originally I was taken by what he had to say, and then I realized, no, I was taken by what he had to say. I think that while he's brilliant and his work was great, I think that some of the conclusions are not correct. So I ended up rewriting everything for this, and I'm glad that I did. I have two questions that I'd like to address. Question number one is, do we support the idea... Well, let me start it from actually one step before. The Torah presents certain taxes. There are certain payments which Judaism requires of Jews that qualify as taxes, and we'll talk more about what those are shortly. But the first question is, do we support the idea of a Jewish, hypothetical Jewish government, or actual Jewish government, perhaps in the state of Israel, creating new taxes after the Torah ends? In other words, after the text of the Torah, even after the Talmud, could the Jewish community say, we need to defend our city. Now we're going to tax the population. We're going to create a mandatory tax everybody has to pay into. That's question number one. And question number two, what kind of taxation would we support? Meaning, there is taxation meant to meet a particular need of society. So we need to fund our military. We need to spend this amount in order to do it, and we're going to divide it up among the citizens in some way geared towards achieving our goal in the end. That's one type of taxation. However, what goes on in North America and in many countries around the world is more than that. It's actually taxation meant to redistribute income in order to achieve some kind of balance in society, right? We are familiar with the concept of progressive taxation. If we're not familiar, that's okay. We're going to come back to it and explain it. But that's what goes on in North America, and I believe in much of Europe as well. I'm not expert in global taxation policies, but the question is Judaism okay with that? Would Judaism consider it ethical to say, this person made a lot of money, this person made very little money, we are going to create taxes which are meant to create benefits for the needy, so that those who are wealthy, the one percenters, to take the number from the media, was that the one percenters will help fund the welfare of the rest of humanity? That's a second question. Is that a Jewish idea? Yeah, some have argued that we should study the Torah's text in order to figure out what tax rates ought to be. Take a look at the first source on the sheet. I love this. It's a paper from the Alabama Law Review. Someone hears me say Alabama that way and knows already where we're going. Professor Susan Hamill, an argument for tax reform based on Judeo-Christian ethics. She writes, from a divine perspective, no person or group of persons, regardless of their station in life, stands at a lesser level of importance than other persons, because all persons were created in God's image. All persons were created in God's image, and therefore, she goes on to say, God protects the vulnerable And our income tax system should be progressive in order to protect the vulnerable. We should design our taxes based on the Bible. And that was actually attempted. They tried that. In source number two, you get an article from a journal called Religion in the News. This was out of Trinity College, I believe. The article is called The Social Gospel Lays an Egg in Alabama. When newly elected Governor Bob Riley, a stalwart low-tax Republican and standard-bearer for the religious right, took a page from the liberal Protestant playbook and announced that the Christian way to solve Alabama's huge budget deficit was to raise taxes, Alabamians and journalists all over the country were amazed. In the end, Riley's daring crusade to persuade Alabamians that Jesus wanted them to raise taxes proved far too novel and far too unpalatable for most Alabama voters. But there you go. There was an attempt to actually create a tax system based on somebody's understanding of what the Torah would want. There's a table here, by the way. We have four seats that are right here. They're available if anyone wants a table to write at. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, let's say somebody genuinely wanted to do that. Let's say that a society genuinely wanted to do that. They wanted to model their taxation on what the Torah prescribes, what Judaism wants. How would they go about doing that? Should there really be such a system? Sorry? So, are they tithes? That's an excellent question. We're going to come back to that in this upcoming section. The way that I want to go about this is first to introduce the issue of taxes in the Torah altogether. What exists as a tax within Judaism? What do you define as a tax? And then get to our two questions of, can a Jewish government create and impose mandatory taxes on citizens? And then the question of this issue of progressive taxation, where you try to actually redistribute wealth. So let's start with taxes in the Torah. I read quite a few papers on this topic, and I found that unfortunately some of the writers who come at it from a Jewish perspective with knowledge about Judaism don't necessarily understand what a tax is. And the writers, it sounds funny to say that, but you'll see what I mean. You'll see what I mean as I go through this. And then the writers from the economic side of it don't really understand what Judaism is doing with its taxes. So what I'm trying to do is to blend the two. In order to do that, we have to start with the definition of tax, so that we're working with common lingo. So if you take a look on your sheet at source number three, this is from Wharton's Concise Law Dictionary. It's a definition that I have found in many countries in their materials online, Australia, India, Western nations as well. It seems to carry all of the common elements of what a tax is understood to be. A compulsory exaction of money by a public authority for public purposes, enforceable by law, and is not payment for services rendered. That's what defines a tax. So again, let's go through it and see what it's saying. First of all, it has to be compulsory. Now, compulsory is tricky. Not because there are people who don't view taxes as compulsory, but compulsory is tricky because it means compulsory if you are in the tax base. So, for example, one type of tax could be a vehicle tax. It's not technically compulsory. You don't have to own a vehicle. But if you own a vehicle, you had better pay this tax. That's what we mean by compulsory. Okay, so that's number one. It is obligatory for all people who are in this class to pay the tax that is levied upon the class as a whole. Number two, it says money here, but it actually doesn't have to be money. I read an article not long ago about how in France there actually is a system whereby artists are able to pay some of their taxes with artwork. Yeah, with artwork donated to the public. Sorry, you read that? You know about that? Okay. It's actually true. You can pay with artwork, but there's a jury that has to actually evaluate the art that's being donated. My fingerprints, you know, this is my. I'm going to send out that also because I think that's great. I'll send out a link in the follow-up email about paying tax with art. I got it off of there's a daily email from a fellow named Dan Lewis who sends out articles like this that I enjoy.
So, Rabbi, they would have to be their own art, or they could send out a work of art?
No. So I believe it's their own art. The point is to help support artists within the country. But number three, in addition to whether it has to be compulsory, money, not necessarily, public authority has to be running this. It has to be run by the government in order for it to be called a tax. That's a key element. For public purposes, it has to be a tax that is levied in order to serve the community, and it can't be a fee for service. If it's a fee for service, then it's not a tax. When I say fee for service, though, this actually gets very interesting in tax law, not so interesting necessarily for us for this discussion. But but what happens if the government charges you for a service, but not all of the fee is actually going into generating that service? So, for example, there's an article from York University, from a professor there that I'm going to be quoting in number 7 and 8. He asks the question, if there's a government-funded lottery, is the price of a lottery ticket a tax? Why isn't it a tax? You don't have to participate. It's not compulsory. But he also argues that you could break down the price of the ticket, because not all of the price of the ticket goes into the prize. Otherwise, the government wouldn't be running the lottery, right? So the argument goes that the part of the price of the ticket that goes to pay the prize or to run the lottery is fee for service. The part that they're going to then use for services, whatever they're doing with the money from the lottery, is a tax. Doesn't matter so much for our discussion, but just something to be aware of. But that's what a tax is. It's compulsory, it's run by the government, and it's going to be used for the community. Clear? Yeah.
But the HST is a fee
for service. The HST is not a fee for service. Why would you say the HST is a fee? Let me ask the question. Why would the HST be a fee for service?
It's a tax on whatever service you're getting or whatever.
Right, but this is a very important distinction, so thank you for pointing that out. Well, when we say a fee for service versus a tax, we don't mean if it's a fee that is tied to receiving a service or getting a product. What we mean is fee for service is where the product is worth X, or the service that's being done for you is worth X, and that's what you're paying. A tax may be triggered by purchasing something or paying for a service, but it's not tied to what it's not based on this is what the service is worth and that's what you're paying for. Or to put it differently, there's a gas tax, right? Whatever percentage is added to the price of a liter of gas. The amount that I pay for the liter of gas is my fee for service. The amount that I pay over and above to the government, because the government wants to make money off of my gas purchase, is a tax, because it isn't going to pay for the gas, it isn't going to pay for the pipeline that brings the gas, it's used for something entirely different, so it's not a fee for service. That's the distinction.
It's just a base for computation.
Exactly, it's a base for computation, it's a convenient way for the government to make money. Sometimes the government will do it as a way to control society. Right? So for example, they don't want people to smoke, so they'll tax tobacco. Right, that's a whole other, that's social engineering, effectively, as a motivation for the tax. Yeah.
So to get a Canadian passport,
yeah,
we pay a fair amount of money. It's considered a tax or a fee.
So if it's only covering the passport administration, then it's a fee. However, if they take a percentage of that and use it to fund, you know, Canada 150 celebrations, then it's a tax. That's the distinction. What are they using the money for? Okay. But that's in terms of what a tax is. But let's move beyond what a tax is and talk about the multiple ways to tax. There are lots of ways that you can tax a society. But there are three that I want to highlight here. The first is called regressive. When you have a regressive tax, what that means is people who make less money or people who have less will end up paying a higher percentage of their assets for the tax. And people who make more or have more assets will pay a lower percentage. So we tax the poor at a higher rate than we tax the wealthy. That's called a regressive tax. Lest you say, where in the world will that exist? The answer is everywhere. It's called a lump sum tax. So for example, as we're going to come back to, when the Jews build the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the traveling temple they have on their way from Egypt into the land of Israel, there's a tax. Everyone has to pay how much? Machatzit shekel, a half shekel. Everyone pays a half shekel, and the Torah specifies whether you are wealthy or whether you're poor, it doesn't make a difference. Everybody pays a half shekel, and that becomes an annual tax for the upkeep of the temple and the bringing of offerings. Well, if you're a wealthy person, a half shekel is a tiny, tiny percentage of your assets. If, on the other hand, you're indigent, then it's a much larger percentage of your assets. It's a regressive, to any lump sum tax is going to be regressive. Clear? Okay. Then you have a second type. The second type is a flat proportion. I gave you this in source number 4. You can see the descriptions there. In a flat proportion, the percentage is the same for everybody. So it's going to be, let's say, 10%, 15%, 20%, whatever it is, of your income is going to go for whatever the tax is. Or you buy gas, and it's going to be whatever the percentage is that is the gas tax, whatever their 15%, 14%, whatever it is, it's the same for everybody across the board. It's a flat proportion. And at first, it sounds like a flat proportion hits everybody equally. But some argue this is also technically regressive because the 10% or the 15% or the 20% is more meaningful for an indigent person than for a wealthy person. If somebody makes $100,000 a year and they're going to pay, let's say, 20% in their taxes, I'm making up numbers obviously, that leaves them with $80,000 for their annual expenditures. If you have somebody who makes $1 million and pays 20%, that leaves them with $800,000 for their annual expenditures. The 20% hit is more meaningful for the person who's economically weaker than it is for the person who's economically stronger. On the other hand, generally societies that have this sort of flat percentage deal will also have exemptions for people who make less money or whatever it is. They balance it out a little bit. They'll say if your first X number of dollars are not taxed. For example, the third type is the progressive income tax. That's the one that you're familiar with in Canada. It's the one they use in the U.S., in many countries. And in there, you say, people who make up to a certain amount pay 10%. Then there's a higher bracket that's going to be 20% and a higher bracket that's going to be 30%, and it goes however high it goes in that country. It is called progressive because it progresses. The higher your income, the higher the tax. Marlene? Oops. Yeah, you're right. Should have written progressive there. That's funny. Okay, thanks for catching that. On the sheet in number 4, nothing to get people's attention like a mistake. In number 4, the third bullet point, it should say progressive, not regressive. Thank you. So, nothing is truly straightforward within these systems. You have elements like tax-deferred savings, you have income exemptions, you have all sorts of balancing effects on an income tax. There's also a sales tax. There are all sorts of other ways in which society will take money from one and give it to another. But the point is that you need to know the definition of what a tax is, and you need to know how society is taxed in order to get a handle on what it is that Judaism is doing. Within Judaism, there are various payments that might qualify as taxes. So take a look at source number 5, where I gave you a collection of biblical verses describing different taxes. The first one there, number 5, is what I mentioned already, the half shekel. The half shekel is a lump sum tax. It is inherently regressive. it will cost more for needy people than it will for wealthier people. The next line there, in number 5, is regarding your harvest, and it outlines certain mitzvot related to harvesting. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not complete reaping the corner of your field. This is called in Hebrew pe'ah. Pe'ot are the corners. If you're familiar with the term pe'as, right, for the sideburns, it's the corner of the jaw. They are the corner of the head, as the Torah phrases it. So, you shall not complete the corner of your field, meaning when I harvest my field, I have to leave a corner, which technically has no amount linked to it. It could be a smaller percentage, it could be a larger percentage, it has to be the end of the field, so that the needy know where to find it. I have to leave that for the needy. You shall not collect the leket of your harvest. Leket of the harvest is a reference to the stuff you drop. The harvester is going around the field, picks up this, picks up this, picks up this, drops accidentally some. Whatever he dropped is called a leket, and he's not allowed to go back for it. He has to leave it for the gleaners. If you're familiar with the story of Ruth, right? So that's what you're talking about there. She's gathering after the harvesters. That's called leket. There's another mitzvah which isn't specified right here. It's elsewhere in the Torah called shichacha. Lishka, what is lishkalach? To forget. In the event that the harvester skips the spot, they can't go back for it. They have to leave it for the needy to be able to collect it. There are caps on this, meaning if you leave a certain size, like more than a certain amount, then you can go back for it. We're not going to make the farmer go broke because the harvester did a bad job. If you drop more than a certain amount, you're able to go back for it. There's a cap on what you're going to have to give. And you shall not take the lone grapes of your vineyard. The lone grapes of your vineyard means, if you picture the classic Kedem bottle bunch of grapes, right, which is nicely structured, it's the upside down pyramid. So anybody who has grapevines knows, they don't look like that. You have to like know what you're doing in order to get grapes that consistently look like that. And very often what you'll have are lone grapes, a grape here, a grape there. Those are called olalot in Hebrew. You're not allowed to collect those. You have to leave that for the needy. As well as peret of your vineyard, and that's talking about the grapes that you drop. If you drop the grapes, leave it for them to take. Leave it for the pauper and the stranger. I am Hashem, your God. This is also a sort of tax, right? In the sense that you're told, leave it for the needy. It doesn't fit neatly into any of the categories that we've identified because there's no clear percentage. We kind of assume that it's going to be roughly the same percentage everywhere you harvest. We don't actually know that. Another type of tax that's seen is meant to support the priests. If you take a look still in number 5, this will be the law of the priests from the nation. He shall give the priest, if you slaughter an animal, you're supposed to give to the Kohen, the priest who works in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, the foreleg, the jaw, and the stomach of the animal. Anytime. This isn't a carbon, this isn't a sacrifice. This is any time you would give this to the Kohen, to the priest. And in addition, there are all sorts of other gifts that go to them. The first of your grain, wine, and oil, the first of the shearing of your wool, you give to the priest as well. Then there are taxes for the Levi, for the Levites. They have to get as well. To the Levites I have given, the end of source number 5, all of the tithe in Israel for a portion in exchange for their service as they serve in the tent of meeting. You have to give a tenth to the Levi. And then you get the tax that people are most familiar with, which is not actually biblical according to most authorities. Someone mentioned tithing before. The idea of what's called in Hebrew maaser ksafim, that you take a tenth of your income and you give it to the needy, right? We're familiar with that. You will not find a biblical verse that requires that. What you will find is the promise that Jacob made to God when he ran away from home, fleeing from his brother who wanted to kill him. And there he says to God, in source number 6, "And everything you give me, I shall tithe for you." And based on that, we have the idea of a 10% tithe. There's a lot of debate as to how this is viewed in Jewish law. Is it a rabbinic mitzvah? Is it just custom? How exactly? Not just custom. Is it custom? There are different ways to take it. Those are your basic taxes that emerge from the text of the Torah, but Jewish communities over time did not rely only on those. As we're going to see from the Talmud and from the Code of Jewish Law, Jewish communities ran their own systems of taxation, both independently and as agents of larger governments. So in other words, you had a concept called Sheva Tuvei Ha'ir, the town council, that goes all the way back to Roman times, possibly even earlier, and continued into the Middle Ages. The practice was that you had a town council chosen democratically, and they were responsible for the affairs of the community. And if they said, we need a building project, we need to build a wall to defend ourselves from attack, or they said, we need to fund guards for the city, or we need to take care of a water supply, or whatever it was, they would levy a tax on the community. So you have taxes like that. And then you also have the tax that they would take on behalf of the larger government. In other words, the Jews are living under the Poles. The Poles say to the Jewish community, we will give you the right to govern yourselves autonomously. However, you have to pay us a tax every year. This is the sum of money, this many florins, or whatever the current currency is, and you figure out how you're going to get it. And then the local Jewish government has to figure out how to collect that from the citizens. So that ends up happening as well, rabbinically. All of these different taxes, we have a long history, both biblically and rabbinically, of collecting taxes from ourselves. Are we clear on this? Good? Okay. So, the question of, can a Jewish government really impose new taxes is sort of answered. Because I've already just told you that we did. But let's see a little bit more, get a better understanding of what this is and how it works. Last week we talked about choosing candidates, how you decide for whom to vote. And as part of that discussion, we defined Jewish government in a particular way. And that matters a great deal when you figure out how taxation is actually going to work. You see, secular government is supposed to do what? What is the role of government in general society? What are they supposed to do? Argue with each other. What else are they supposed to do?
Take care of us.
Take care of us.
Keep order.
Keep order. Build roads, hospitals, and schools. Everything you're saying comes under the heading of provider of services. Yeah?
Well, I was going to say, it's just a group in effect that you can't do yourself.
Right. Precisely. If we were to all build our own schools and build our own hospitals, it would be chaos and it wouldn't be very effective and it would be very, very expensive. Government is told, we want you to provide these services. That's one role of government. Another role of government is legislative. They have to create the rules by which society is going to function. Because again, if I decide that I declare a 20 kilometer an hour speed limit outside of my house, right, and you decide that outside of your house it's going to be 5 kilometers and someone else's house is going to be 30 kilometers, how in the world is that going to work and how is it ever going to be enforced? So we turn to government to create and enforce the laws. But then there's a third role of government that is accepted, generally speaking, pretty much globally. Take a look at source number 7. This comes from a book called The Logic, Policy, and Politics of Tax Law by Professor Neil Brooks from York. And he says the following regarding government. At the most basic level, we have taxes because we have governments. Collecting taxes is simply one of the ways that the government has to achieve its broad social and economic objectives. The efficient allocation of resources, and thus the maximization of social welfare, is the normative government objective that preoccupies economists. Government is going to collect taxes in order to fund what it's doing for the community as a service, as part of taking care of society. So that's the general way of looking at government. But last week we said that we have different views of how Jewish government works. We identified three elements. Now, I'm not going to test those who were here last week and say, ha, do you remember the three elements of Jewish government? Unless anyone wants to volunteer it. Number one is religious. Number one, not necessarily in order of priority, but number one in the way we presented it last week, is the government's role is religious. We said that the Noahide laws, the laws that apply to all human beings, require that we create laws to govern society, as explained by Nachmanides last week. We create government with the goal of having them legislate how society should run. That's number one. It's a religious element. Number two, the protective element. We said that there is a rule of creating shoftim v'shotrim, judges and officers, people who are going to protect society, defend people from harm. And that's a second element of what Judaism expects government to do. So there's the element of creating law as a religious duty of government, there's the element of protecting society from harm, and then there's a broad category, we said, the democratic responsibility of expressing the will of the people. Whatever it is that the society wants government to do is effectively the mandate of government. That's what they are now supposed to do. Those are your three roles of government. So sometimes a Jewish government is religious in the sense that it's supposed to carry out God's will by enforcing, by creating and enforcing the law. And if they take that view, then if the Torah says citizens should pay 10% of the levy, or if the Torah says citizens should leave the gleanings for the needy, then that becomes the role of government, to compel people to fulfill a religious obligation. Now, you'll tell me, we live in a society in which there are Jews and non-Jews. You are 100% correct. They will not be able to enforce a Jewish obligation on a non-Jewish society in a hypothetical world or in a real world, in Israel. If you have a government that controls a society in which Jews and non-Jews live, that doesn't mean that the government is going to say, now everybody has to give to the Levite. It's still only for Jews to give to the Levite, and that's what government would be expected to enforce. And Jewish government does have the ability to do this. However,
what about something like Shemitah?
Well, Shemitah wouldn't be viewed as a tax, because you don't take money from one party and give it to another, but it is within government's authority, yes. But it's not a tax.
It would be a conditional on non-Jews as well.
No.
Just on Jews.
Yeah. There's a lot of discussion related to that. There are permutations that come from that, but basically the answer is no, it wouldn't be for non-Jews. But in terms of this issue, I want to come back and clarify a point regarding the agricultural taxes that we're talking about, and regarding tzedakah. Based on what we've said so far, is tzedakah a tax? Why not? But it's not voluntary. The Torah says you are to give, or it's rabbinic, or it's minhag, you know, custom of the community, 10% of your income goes to the needy.
But you benefit from that because you can, taxes, you actually
so the side issue, which is I get a tax receipt, did I really give 10% if the government gave me X percentage back? That's a very good point. But let's pretend you're not filing your tax receipt from the charitable gift. Let's deal with it purely. Is it a tax when the Torah says that I'm supposed to give 10% to the levy, 10% to the needy? Is it a tax? Not done by public authority. Precisely. That was going to say? It's not done by public authority. Right? You get to decide who's going to receive it. Right? I can choose. I can go to whatever, Canadian Friends of whatever organization I like in Israel. I could go to any number of organizations that support the needy. I can go to any, well, whatever. You get the point. It's my decision where I spend it. So is it a tax or isn't it a tax? Yeah?
I just wanted to know, isn't the definition of tzedakah given voluntarily?
Why?
No, that's a definition under Canadian tax law. That's not the Torah definition.
So, right. The literal definition of the word tzedakah, no, does not require that it be voluntary. There's some debate as to how to translate the word tzedakah, but the most common one is actually from the word tzedek, which is justice. That this is the right, so to speak, of the needy to receive that from the person who gives. There's a lot to be said about that. The difference between charity, which is the Christian term reflecting love, and tzedakah, which seems to reflect justice, and then in Islam the term zakat, which is a whole other thing. They all are used to refer to philanthropy, but in very different ways. The idea, I mean, to just say, make one point about it because it's a fascinating topic, is that within Christianity it has to be given out of love in order to qualify. If it's not out of love, it didn't qualify. Whereas within Judaism, It's what the recipient deserves. Don't start. I know what you're going to say. Within Judaism, it's what the recipient deserves, and it's only that the item should actually get to the recipient, such that if I have a hole in my pocket and the money drops out and a needy person finds it, I gave tzedakah. Mind you, it's not the highest quality of tzedakah. I didn't even know I was doing it. But it happened. And in Islam, it's tied to sacrifice. So if you give an amount that isn't meaningful for you, you didn't fulfill what they want you to do. Not being a scholar on Muslim law, I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of how that might apply. But there actually are different perceptions of what tzedakah is about. But no, as far as we are concerned, it can be compulsory and still qualify as tzedakah. But going back to our point here, what really, the way I look at the these tithes, which we get to distribute, is maybe we could look at it the way I put from source number 8 from Professor Brooks. I'm not going to read it aloud in the interest of time, but it's more like a tax credit. It's more like a tax credit in the sense that the government is saying that it wants to take this amount from me, but it is entitling me to spend it in the way that I choose, with whatever recipients fit what the government wants. In the same way that the government may say that, you know, when I lived in Pennsylvania, there was a tax credit where certain corporations could take the money that they owed in taxes, a certain chunk of that, and give it to schools instead of paying it to the state. Yeah. Education tax credit. So governments may say, we just care that it goes to certain causes. You can choose which cause you want to give it to. So that's the way I really look at that. But in any case, to a certain extent, the Jewish government is going to be carrying out and enforcing the existing taxes of the Torah. To another extent, the government is a provider of services, funding its role in protecting society and in serving the community's needs. And in that sense, we look at the community as a partnership. Within Judaism, we have certain rules for the way partnerships work. Let's say that Ian and I own a yard in which I live at one end of the yard and Ian lives at the other end of the yard. We have an open space between us that we use freely. I can keep my stuff nearer to his house. He can keep stuff nearer to my house. Doesn't make a difference. One day, I say, you know what? I would actually like to have some privacy. So I would like to build a wall in which it's going to divide the yard evenly. I'm not taking anything of yours. But I want to have 50% of the yard here. You'll have 50% of the yard on the other side. The rule is that Ian is required to get 50% of the cost of that wall. I can, as a resident on the yard, we own the yard in partnership, it's fair for me to say, I'd like to have some privacy in my half, and you and I will together pay for the wall up to a certain height, to the minimum height. If I want it to be taller, then it's all on me. If I want it to be built out of unusually strong materials, that's on me. But otherwise, we do this evenly. That's what's in source number 9. If the wall collapses, then we both spend in order to rebuild it. That's the way this works Talmudically, is we have shared responsibility in a partnership. It's not only about owning property. Take a look at source number 10. This is a fun case. If a caravan is traveling in the wilderness and is attacked by soldiers to loot it, okay, people come along and say, we want your money, but you can just pay us a ransom. How do we decide what people pay in for the ransom? They calculate the ransom burden based on wealth, not lives. In other words, if there are 10 of us in the group, and the attackers are going to take all of our money if we don't pay them ransom, we don't say that each member of the caravan pays 10%. Why not?
They don't have a choice.
No. Among ourselves, how are we going to come up with the ransom money? Why don't we say that each person pays
10%? Because some may be very wealthy and some may be poor.
Yes, some of them have a lot to lose, and some of them don't. Some of them have very little. You're not really protecting that much for them. So what we do is we say, what percentage of the assets in this caravan do you have? That's the percentage of the ransom that you're going to pay. As opposed to, if the attackers are planning on killing them, in which case it's even. We're all partners. We all have the same stake, and therefore we're all going to be responsible to pay equally, it sounds like. That's going to be modified later on. But the point is that we have this concept of partnership in a community that has particular needs, and we see that regarding how government works. When government taxes a population, we view the population as partners. I brought that view from the Code of Jewish Law, number 11. The residents of a city are viewed as partners in any municipal need, and therefore they have to pay for the services that they are going to use. So, as an example, I brought you in source number 12 that if you want to build a guardhouse, if they want to build a door for the yard, whatever it is, people who have lived in the city for 12 months are required to pay for the defense of the city. That's the idea. And as the source continues in number 12, even the orphans are going to have to pay for the city's defense because they need protection. However, the rabbis apparently don't need protection. Their study is protecting them. Try that on the Canadian government. Let me know how that works. That's the concept is that if you benefit from a service, you're going to be responsible to pay for the service, and you'll pay based on your use. That's the way that it works. So what we've said so far, and this feels a little bit like, you know, drier than last week's material because it's taxes. You showed up knowing that it was taxes. But what we've accomplished so far is an understanding of how taxes work in general, and the idea that within Judaism, the government is going to be seen as enforcing the religious rules of taxation to a certain extent. The meaning on Jews, telling them you have to pay these taxes that the Torah expects of you. And then separate from that, as a provider of services, is going to get people to fund the services that they provide. But here's where things get a little bit stranger. Or not stranger, but different anyway. And that is when you talk about handling new needs. Something that is a new need. Let's say a Jewish community forms and they need a synagogue. Can you tax the community to build the synagogue? The answer is, you bet. Source number 14. Residents may force each other to build a synagogue, to acquire a Torah scroll, to acquire the texts of the prophets. That's a source going back to the Tosefta, which is a couple of thousand years old. Well, how is it going to be paid? Take a look at source number 15, the Code of Jewish Law, talking about paying a cantor. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, first piece of this is from Rabbi Yosef Karo, writing in the city of Tzfat in Israel. He says they pay the cantor from the communal pot, which is really funds that are expected to be, you know, given by the wealthy for the use of the needy. Although he fulfills his role for needy and wealthy alike, the needy cannot afford as the wealthy can. So in other words, you take funds that the wealthy are predominantly giving, because you can't really expect the needy people to be the ones who are going to pay the cantor. So what we're going to do is take money from the wealthier in order to be able to afford it. And then you have a distinction. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in Krakow, roughly the same time, a little bit later than Rabbi Karo, says, some say we collect half based on wealth and half as a head tax. And this is the communal custom. Half based on wealth and half based on a head tax. So in other words, if we're paying the cantor $20,000, $10,000 will be raised as a head tax. Everybody pays. If there are 100 people in the community, each one pays in $100. And then half of it, the other $10,000, will do based on what you can afford. What's the logic in saying that? What's the logic in taking that approach, Sheila?
Well, in a way, everybody participates, but people can afford more, paying more.
Right. Everybody's going to participate, but you recognize fundamentally that not everybody is able to afford the total, and so we're going to bias it a little bit. This actually goes back to a passage in the Talmud that I did not bring you on the sheet, which gives the same idea when you're dealing with a group of people who are attacked by bandits who want to kill them. The suggestion is, you know what? Split it. On the one hand, everybody's benefiting. So let it be a head tax. On the other hand, if you make it a head tax, you can't afford it. So, all right, so we'll bias it towards the wealthy paying a little bit more than everybody else. So sorry. Why doesn't pay the cantor less? And the answer is you won't have a cantor. No, the answer is you won't have a cantor then. That's, you can try that. It all depends on whether it's a buyer's market or a seller's market.
What if you don't have, what if the poor guy doesn't have money for the head tax?
If the guy doesn't have money for the head tax, then he's going to have to collect from charity in order to be able to manage it. It's going to end up being on the community. That's what will end up happening. I'm actually coming back to that at the end, so hold that question. Yeah?
Can they not also, do not religious organizations get exemption from taxes? Wouldn't that be a benefit?
So not within the Jewish system. Not within the Jewish system. There is no such thing as the exemption for the organization. Here they do, correct, yeah. Right. So the cantor is getting a fee for service. It's the community that's levying a tax on its citizens to cover it. But you're right. I think you're right. I hear you. Really what we're doing is applying the system of taxation to what amounts to a fee for service in the sense that it all goes directly to the cantor. I hear the point. Yeah. I think you could disagree. I think I could go further with it, but I'm not going to in the interest of time. I think that you could actually argue that point. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the difference between a communal tax and a communal fine.
Yeah. How? I don't understand.
Well, for instance, if you had to pay to have your camel tied up, if they would like to do it for the services for caravans, for camels to be tied to something, I don't know, that's like the Wild West, you know, cash.
Yeah.
And then if you don't,
it's
a parking meter.
Right.
Is that a tax or is that a fine?
Got it. So I think it's a fine because it's illegal for you to do whatever it is. Someone asked me this question. It is discussed in Jewish law. In the event that I break down the wall between my property and somebody else's, so now I'm going to have to pay for it. So is that something I'm allowed to do if I choose to and I just have to pay for it? Or do we view it as you did something illegal and now you are paying and what you did was a transgression? Same question comes up with parking tickets.
Yeah.
Right? Is it that it's illegal to park there or that's just a really expensive parking spot? Complete with valet service as they move your car away. Right. It's an interesting question. It's a little beyond the scope though. But my point in bringing this is to show you that we have precedent for Jewish government saying, we are going to tax society in order to meet the needs of the community, and we're not going to make it all a head tax. We're going to try to balance things so that the wealthier are going to provide greater support than the needy. And you see it in general communal needs. I brought it as source, which we're not going to go through in source number 16. It's a longer discussion, but imposing on the community this payment. I will look at number 17 because 17 is easier. 17 dealt with a problem that a Jewish community in Poland had. Yes, Sarah.
Where does this mosque?
I'm going to get there. I'll get there by the end, God willing. The Jewish community in Poland had a problem. The general non-Jewish authorities did not want to allow them to carry out shechita, to kill the animals. This wasn't, you're talking 16th century Poland. It wasn't animal rights. That's not what we're talking about. But they saw a way to extract funds from the Jewish community. They said, you want a shecht? You want to slaughter an animal? Sure. The community must pay us 40 gold coins a year as a fee for the right to be able to slaughter the animals. So here's the question now. Do we say every time somebody slaughters, we project that the community is going to slaughter 400 animals a year. Let's pretend. So therefore, we know that per shechita, it's one-tenth of a gold coin. And if we do that, and we collect one-tenth of a gold coin each time, we'll have 40 gold coins by the end. That's one way that you could do it. Right? However, not everybody can afford one-tenth of a gold coin. So take a look at what Rabbi Yosef Katz, in source number 17, wrote. He said, he describes the situation. They arranged with the non-Jews to pay them 40 gold coins annually. The wealthy want to tax each slaughtered animal a large sum, calculated such that the annual burden will match the tax collected, right? One-tenth of a gold coin every time you slaughter. Total will be 40 gold coins. The needy, meaning those who slaughter many animals, not all the needy people, but the needy people who have large families to feed, They want to pay the tax based on the assets of each citizen, not based on the animals. Right? They want to say, 40 gold coins, we have 100 people living in the town, divide it up and let each person pay 1% of the 40 gold coins. And his answer was, it appears to me the paupers are correct. That the system of taxation should be biased towards taking the money from those who are able to afford it. That's the system he wants to use. Why can the government do that? What empowers the government to take money from people in that way? So you could view it in one of two ways. Either they're exercising the right of tzedakah, they are compelling people to give such that the needy will be supported. It's a religious act that the government is engaged in. Or alternatively, you could say, this is democracy. This is the will of the community. This is the way Jewish communities function, is that they have the payment made by the wealthy in order to cover the needs of the needy. That's the other possibility. Rabbi Moshe Isserl has made that argument in source number 18. He says that it's communal custom that empowers the government to do what they do. So to sum up what we've said so far, and make sure that we're somewhat clear. Number one, biblically, you have lump sum taxes and you have flat proportion taxes as well. Whether they're distributed by the government or distributed by the individual. That's number one. Number two, historically, Jewish governments have taxed the community as a way to enforce the Torah's taxes, as well as to pay for services provided on behalf of the community. And they've done it sometimes with lump sum taxes, and they've done it sometimes with a proportion. You give X percentage of your wealth. They've done it both ways. They've done it with blends. And when it has come to new needs, religious or civil, we find new taxes which tend to be biased towards having the wealthy pay, apparently with a flat proportion. Are we clear on that? Uh-oh. Again, Jewish governments have taxed their populations. Okay, Jewish governments have taxed their populations. They have taxed their populations to make them pay what the Torah says they should pay. They have taxed their populations for new communal needs as well. And they have biased it towards the wealthy covering the needs of the needy, like in the kosher slaughter case that you see right here, or like in the discussion of hiring a chazan. They said, we can't put it all on the needy people to do it. A regressive tax isn't going to work. What we need instead is to say, the wealthy people are going to have to pick up what the needy people are not able to cover. What empowered them to do this? Either it's an act of tzedakah, they are helping the wealthier people to support the needier people, or the way to look at it is, this is communal custom. There is simply enforcing what communities do. It's the will of the people that it should be done this way, and that's why we do it. That's what we have so far. We aren't done though, but that's what we have so far. What's missing here, and what I think is very important to note, is the issue of progressive tax. Meaning everything we've talked about empowers the government either to do a lump sum tax or to do some kind of percentage, but it's a flat percentage for the wealthy. So in other words, we're going to say that the needy people are going to provide a head tax, whatever it's going to be, and then we're going to divide up the rest and say that the wealthy people have to give X percentage of their wealth, 10%, 15%, whatever it is, to pay. What we haven't seen is the progressive tax in which you say the needy people are going to give, let's say 5%. Wealthier people give 15%, still wealthier people give 35%, still wealthier give 40%, whatever it is, we haven't seen the graduated tax bracket system. You follow? So some have wanted to argue over the ages that actually this is what the Torah is doing. That actually, that when we say calculate it based on people's assets, what we actually mean is do the tax brackets in this way, create a system where wealthy people who have one level of wealth give this, still wealthier people give more, but I don't see evidence of it in the text that they're quoting. I just don't see it. I don't think it's true. I think that in general, Jewish law is probably not in favor of a progressive tax in which the government says that we're going to raise your tax bracket if you have more money. I don't think that they... When we say calculate based on assets, I think what we mean is people who have means give this percentage, people who don't have means give that percentage, and that's it. It's not graduated in that way. And then the question is, why not? Why wouldn't we go with tax brackets in that way? So I think the reason why we don't do that is because it's perceived as theft. I think it's perceived as theft for you to do so.
I have a question before you say, maybe I'm confused.
Yeah.
You keep using the term Jewish law.
Yeah.
Can you tell us up to what era you're when you talk about Jewish law?
Good. So, right. No, I think it's an important point. We started out by talking about biblical text. We then progressed with the Talmudic ideas of partnership and of empowering the community to collect for services that are provided to everybody. That's 2,000 years ago. We then moved into its application in communities post-Talmud, in which we gave largely cases from and sources from 11th to 16th, 17th century, mostly Ashkenazi communities. So you're talking Poland, Eastern Europe, that area, certainly as you move towards 15th, 16th century, post the expulsion from Spain. So that's really what we're talking about. What I'm not doing is, what does the modern Israeli government do? Because they're not necessarily asking, what does Jewish law want?
The concept of the progressive tax as we know it is very modern. I mean, that's just... early 20th century.
So that's a really interesting question. Are progressive taxes really that new? Those who are arguing that when the Talmud says you calculate based on wealth, that means that if you're wealthier, you're paying a higher percentage, they believe that actually we were doing progressive taxes 2,000 years ago. Now, I'm not a scholar of tax law, and I didn't look. I should have looked, really, to find out the history of progressive taxation and see when it started. But the truth is, it doesn't sound like such a modern idea. The idea of progressive taxation, the idea that if you have a certain amount of wealth, you're going to pay more, a higher percentage, it doesn't sound so...
The tax based on wealth could be a percentage of your wealth.
Right,
that's
but
we call it. Right. In the United States, the state tax, for example, right now, it's a tax on wealth.
Right.
That's the same
percentage. Right, and that's what I thought the sources were saying. But again, I don't think that they're crazy for thinking that it will be an older idea. I don't think that that's illegitimate as a read. But I do think, and this is going to take me back to this point in general about progressive taxation, I think that it's viewed as theft. Because what you're doing is, as I brought in number 20, you are profiting some people while harming others. And fundamentally, that's a power that the community shouldn't have. To make a rule which is going to say, you're going to give more, and you're going to get more, redistributing wealth effectively, I think is something that is uncomfortable for us. So that the source that I bring you, right, Mordechai ben Hillel in 13th century Germany, will only allow it if there is universal agreement among the town council. He will only allow you to collect from some people in a way that will harm them, but help others to do this kind of targeted hit in the event that the entire council agrees. So that a Jewish community that wants to do this, a Jewish community that wants to take a progressive approach and not just do a proportion of wealth, I think that the way they're going to have to do it is one of two ways. Either a universal agreement within the governing council that this is okay, they are empowered to do it, as we saw in number 20, or alternatively, to say, we can't do this as a government, we're going to go back to the people and say, we want the people to do this. In other words, the government lacks the power to do this in a mandatory way. And this is my last point. We're running up to time in a minute and 12 seconds. The approach would be to say the government cannot mandate it. However, the population has a duty. We have a broad principle in Judaism which says that we are responsible to look after each other. And we employ that within Jewish law where the government's safety net ends. We require family, we require community to take care of each other. If you take a look at source number 21, Professor Adam Khodorov in Biblical Tax Systems and the Case for Progressive Taxation, and that is a page-turner, says, those opposed to progressive taxation have argued that the religious obligation to care for the poor is personal, not communal, and it must be voluntarily undertaken. The argument that tzedakah is in fact meant to be voluntary. That would be the argument that that Professor Khodorov makes. And so if you take a look at source number 22 in the Code of Jewish Law, we are told that even though the standard tzedakah amount is supposed to be 10% of your income, a person can give up to 20%. Of his income. And a person who can't afford 10% goes down to at least a third of a shekel a year, which is based on a biblical tax in the book of Nehemiah. But the idea is that the individual is relied upon to cover that which the community is not empowered to do. So if a Jewish community says we want to enforce progressive taxation, if a Jewish government were to say we want progressive taxation, I think there's an argument to be made that it's not within their power to do so, unless you have the support of the entire governing council to say this is what we were elected to do. But barring unanimity, which how often is a Jewish governing council going to be unanimous? Barring that, you don't have the ability to compel. You have to expect people to handle it themselves. And that brings me to my last source, number 23, where Moses Maimonides says something important about this, and it takes me back to the Gemach question. Gemach, for those who aren't familiar with the term, stands for Gemilut Chasadim, giving to others, right? Acts of generosity. And it's a term that's used for community collections. There are gemachs for all sorts of things. Toronto has a gemach for car seats, so that people who can't afford car seats are able to get car seats that way. There are gemachs for brides' gowns for weddings. There are gemachs for all sorts of purposes to meet the needs within a community. So take a look at 23. Maimonides wrote back in the 12th century, every city with a Jewish population must appoint tzedakah collectors from themselves, people who are known and trustworthy, who will circulate among the nation from Friday to Friday, taking from each person that which the person is suited to give and that which is set for him. So on the one hand, it's whatever you're suited to give, and on the other hand, you're going to be told what you're suited to give. This is the way the campaign works. They distribute it from Friday to Friday, giving each pauper food for 7 days, and this is what is called kupa. And they also appoint collectors who take daily from each yard bread and kinds of food or fruit or money from any who give at the moment. And there's no set amount, it's just they go door to door. They distribute the collected materials that evening among the needy, giving each pauper his needs for the day, and this is what is called tamchui. We have never seen or heard of a Jewish community that did not have a kupah of tzedakah, Maimonides writes. Tamchui, the latter one, exists in some places, not in others. It's a hybrid of the two. It is, on the one hand, government instituted and government set. They're going to tell you what to do, and it's government enforced. They're going to go to your door. But on the other hand, each party gives as they can. It's based on their means. And so what I would contend at the end of the day is that I think that an enforced system of progressive taxation is in hazy territory in Jewish law. On the one hand, it's recognized.
It is progressive taxation. That's exactly what it says.
In a sense.
If God comes to your door and says you have to give according to your needs.
Yeah.
That is progressive taxation. There's no real difference. It's saying if you have more than the guy next door to you, you have to give more. It's saying based on your needs.
So you're saying that. So then you're going to go back and say that this is actually graded.
But it doesn't work, obviously, in a huge city. You can't go door to door and figure out how much each guy can give. I do not perceive any difference.
So you think that this text would be saying that... Hang on. So what you're saying is that in a city in which you have people who have, I'm making up numbers now, $100,000 in income and $200,000 and $300,000, they wouldn't simply say, we want all of you to give 15%, but to the 100,000 person, they'll say, we want you to give 15%. To the 200,000 person, they'll say, we want you to give a higher percent. And the 300,000, they'll say, we want you to give an even greater percent.
According to what you're suited to give.
Right, but I still don't know why that can't be based on a percentage.
Right.
Because I have a problem with that based on the fact that we've been given a cap of 20% on what so on what one can give.
This tax. If there's a cap, maybe some rabbis have written about that.
No, I mean, the cap that he gives, the cap that you saw in 22 is from Maimonides as well. It's not like it's the invention of Rabbi Kara writing later. Okay. I hear. So it's reasonable people will disagree regarding what this says. And you could make the argument that this is progressive. You could make the argument it's proportional. But what I think we do see here, one more minute. What I think we do see here, and I think is important to note, is that we're trying to balance that point that we started our first week with, which is the citizen versus the individual. And on the one hand, we look after the needs of the individuals within the community, and we don't want to overburden them or burden them in a way that is unfair. And on the other hand, we expect them to pay in for the community as citizens, and we look to the wealthy to balance that which the needy are not able to provide. And we're trying to juggle both, which is what leads to systems like this. I think I hear the point about reading it as progressive, and others have read it the way that you do. Until 5 minutes ago, I disagreed with them staunchly. Now maybe I disagree with them less. I hear what you're saying. But fundamentally, what this tells us is we have a long history of taxing and of inventing taxes as the community had needs. And you can make the argument for lump sum, where everybody is using the service the same way. Historically, we have veered towards a bias towards asking the wealthy to make up what the needy cannot. Whether that system was progressive in which we actually increased the percentage of the wealth we were taking as somebody had more assets, or whether we said that it's going to be based on a percentage that will just apply uniformly, I think that can be debated. Next week, God willing, Rabbi Ziering will be giving the class for week 3. I believe his topic is the Jewish lobby. The issue of lobbying government for the needs of the Jewish community in a general society. So please be here for 10 o'clock next week. Thank you very much.